My name is Jack Brennan, and I'm an alcoholic. And I do come from Kansas. By way of Brooklyn. And if you have any trouble understanding me tonight, I have a little trouble understanding you, too. I like it in Kansas fairly well. I don't think I'll make another summer. It's as hot as hell. And they're very funny people down there. They're not like Brooklyn at all. They leave their doors open. They're very friendly. They want to see if they can do anything for you at all times. And it's all in all a pretty nice place. They're educating me, too. I bet you that you don't know why cowboys die with their boots on. Because they can't get them off, that's why. I learned that since I'm in Kansas. And Kansas is the home of a lot of country western singers. And one that's down there quite often is Loretta Lynn. And you should all know her. A lot of people think that Al-Anon has no theme song, but it does. And Loretta Lynn wrote it, and she sings it very well. And the name is, Don't Come Home A-Drinking With Lovin' On Your Mind. I've been to many conventions, and always they say that the mayor will be there. And there was only one time that I ever met a mayor at a convention, and that was in Paducah, Kentucky, and he was a woman. I don't know whether it's the strain or what, but I think somebody should send the mayor a little literature. And I would like to see if the police chief was here tonight and ask him what would you do if they all got drunk. That would straighten him out pretty good. I arrived here today, this afternoon. I almost didn't arrive. When we landed in Augusta, the damn pilot hit the ground so hard that all of the oxygen mask came out of the cabinets. And I was a little leery. I hate flying. Flying is for the birds, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I try very hard always to fly American Airlines. It's most reassuring when they come around with the coffee and there's a big AA on the cup, you know. The only damn thing that goes out here is Delta. Well, anyway, I made it. And I'm happy to be here, really. And I'm happy to see all you lovely people. It's a very warm convention, I know that. And I would certainly like to be here for the rest of it. But unfortunately, I have to leave early in the morning and be in Indiana tomorrow evening for another convention. So I'm going to tell you why that I came here tonight. I didn't come here tonight to enjoy the lovely meal that I did have a little while ago. I came here tonight because my friend upstairs wants me to be here. And I don't know how that you feel about this program, but I do believe that it is a God-given and God-inspired program, and that each and all of us sitting here, alcoholics, are miracles. There is no earthly reason for us to be sober tonight. No earthly reason. There are many people that will say, well, doctors do this and psychiatrists do that. And I say no. I say God does it all. He has the last word, always. And when the phone call came for me to come here, I looked at my calendar and I said, I'm sorry, but I have another meeting on that same weekend. And they said that they would settle for Friday night, so here I am. Because any telephone call regarding AA to me is a direct order from the higher power. Because I should not be able to stand here and talk to you people. I should not be able to work. I should not be able to do anything. I should be sitting in a corner of some mental institution with no facility whatsoever to be able to think, or I should be dead and buried many years ago. And the only reason that I do stand here and talk to you and get on planes and fly all over the damn place is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no earthly reason. If Alcoholics Anonymous is, like Bill Wilson told us, a gift from a higher power, then I'm here because of the grace of God. And the God that I feared for so many years, and the God that I cursed, and the God that I hated, I find since I come into AA is a very gentle and very understanding and very loving God. I call him my friend upstairs. And I don't move about in this world, not even 5 paces, unless my friend upstairs knows that I'm going. Because I know from where my help comes. I tried every which way in this world to stay sober and live a normal life and do the best that I could with work and what have you. And I never ever succeeded. Not until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So then, as I say, I came here to talk not to everybody. I came to talk because there is one individual out there that's supposed to hear something that I have to say tonight. My friend upstairs knows how I hate flying and how petrified that I get. And I'm sure that he doesn't send me on any wild goose chases, you know. And I'm here for a reason. One individual. One individual whose life will change because of something that I say here tonight. And it will not be me speaking. All I am, simply, is carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The work you must do yourself. And as our friend here read from his book, that half measures avail of nothing, and that if you want what we have, the first 100 speaking, if you want what we have, then you do as we did. And what the first 100 did, and the first 1,000 of those that went before me did, they took the 12 steps of AA and used them for a guide for a new life. For my new life was here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I came into AA 28 years ago, and I haven't had the desire for a drink or any thought of having a drink in all that time. My life is not in any which way, shape, or form hindered by my alcoholism. I work in Kansas, and I have what is laughingly called a small business. I'm the business, and I do the business, and I do the work, and I hate work with a passion. I hate work. But they frown on the other ways that I know to make money. And you know the stigma never leaves you because you know who we gave the key to the city to. It certainly wasn't me. A key that would fit every door in Augusta. Oh, what a happy thought. So that one individual that I came to speak to, please listen. Please listen. The rest of you can sit there quietly, and I won't keep you too long, really. But I came here to talk to you about the disease of alcoholism and how that affected me and what that I did and what that it's like now. Speaking of your health, the disease of alcoholism, by Dr. Lester Coleman, reprinted from a Philadelphia newspaper, 1965. Very important piece of paper. There's a thumb up here. If you'd like to take one home, would you please do? It says, alcoholism is an actual physical illness, sometimes described as an allergy because it reflects a lack of tolerance to alcohol. And it says, it is not a mental illness. And bouts of excessive drinking commonly produce personality changes in the alcoholic, which are too often mistaken as mental illness. But these temporary changes of personality disappear when the alcoholic returns to sobriety. Goes on further to say that the alcoholic may not want to drink, but he cannot control the impelling drive for the chemical need of sustenance of alcohol. And it goes on further to say that the only effective treatment is complete abstinence. And it goes on even further to say that those people that are suspected of having the disease of alcoholism should associate themselves with the members of Alcoholics Anonymous in order to learn to live with the disease that they have. That is not my words, that's the words of a very fine doctor, and I reprint these things from this newspaper. They're not supposed to be reprinted, of course, but so far I've reprinted about 500,000 of them. And I just wonder what the hell Lester Coleman's going to do about it. You see, I always thought that I was crazy. I always thought that there was something wrong with my head. I knew that I was different from the very first moment that I remember. I came from a family of 9 children. 9 children, 8 normal children, and 1 alcoholic. And that was me. Of course, in those times, nobody knew about the disease of alcoholism because AA has only been with us for 40 years. But when I was a kid, I knew that there was something wrong with me. Because I was born afraid. I was afraid of my father. I was afraid of the nuns in school. I was afraid of anything at all that was slightly different. I didn't like to be called on in school, and if I knew the answer to a question, I wouldn't even tell the answer. And I would sit in a corner like Dinny the Dunce, petrified. And I went to bed at night, I had to leave the light on. If my mother went out shopping and stayed overly long, I would worry about it. I would feel in my mind's eye under a taxi cab, hurt and dead. I never ever knew what it was to draw a pleasant, happy breath in my body. I was born with the disease of alcoholism. And the doctors tell us today that the disease of alcoholism causes us always to be filled with ungrounded and unfounded fear. I didn't know anything about these things. All I knew, I didn't feel good. I hated Christmas because Christmas was a time of trial. My father was an alcoholic. And when he came home drunk, I was petrified. And I would run down the basement and I would hide behind the boiler. And when he sobered up, I would come out. I would sit there and I would cry. And I would curse God and I would curse everybody. And I would say, why don't I have a father like the kid down the block? A father that would buy me a pair of skates. I never had a pair of skates. I never had a bicycle. I never had any of the things that the kids usually have. I never played baseball. I never played football. I would sit on a stoop and wait for my father to come home from work. That was the extent of my life. And when he forced me to go to school in the morning, I would get halfway there and I would be so terrified I would run home again. And my mother didn't know what to do with me. And she would tell me, Jack, why don't you be more like your brother Jimmy? Now, Jimmy was a fine lad. He was a good boy. He went to school, he got good marks, he slept, he hung up his clothes. He did everything right, and I hated his guts. Because I couldn't do anything right, don't you see? I never could do anything right. I was always a round block in a square hole. And no matter if it was raining soup, I would be out with a fork. That's the way that it was. And I tried to be like my brother, and I tried to be like my brother, and I said, to hell with my brother. I just couldn't be like him, so I hated him. And this was in early childhood. And my father used to come home and he used to pick me up and rock me on his knee and tell me everything's going to be all right and he's going to get another job. And he'd say, Jack, I'm going to drink no more. And I'd say, that's good. And I'd run and tell my mother and she'd say, yeah, I know. I've been hearing that for a long time, Jack. Let's see how that it works. And then I would wait for 2, 3, 4 weeks. And the next thing you know, here would my father come around the corner with the hat thrown on the back of his head, hitting both sides of the street, and I knew he was drunk. And the bottom used to fall out of my world. And I used to run in the house, I'd say, Mom, he's coming, he's drunk. And I used to hide all the knives in the kitchen, see, because I didn't want my mother or my father to hurt each other. And then it was a time when all the boys and girls in the house went to bed except Jack. And Jack used to sit in the kitchen between Mom and Pop, and try to keep them from hurting each other. And this is the way that I lived. I was born an alcoholic. I was born with a chemical imbalance in my system. And I didn't know anything about it. All I knew, I didn't feel good. And when Christmas came, I hated it. Generally, my father would fall through the Christmas tree or there'd be a big fight or a big argument. And I used to hate Christmas. And Easter used to bother me, too. Because I always wanted to have enough money, don't you see, to tell my mother to go out and buy herself a new dress or a new pair of shoes, and I never saw her with a new pair of shoes. I never saw her with a new dress. Because with 9 kids and a drunken husband, a husband that would quit a job just as quick as look at you, Well, then there was not much money in my home. And we were very poor people. And I remember even got to the point where when meat was put on the table, I even didn't feel like much to eat because I knew that my mother would always leave herself short in order that the kids would have enough. And I used to understand quite thoroughly, quite well, why. Why were we so poor? And why did I often catch my mother crying in her apron, you know, very softly, but crying in her apron? And I knew the answer, my father's drinking. I knew that my father was something wrong with him, and I thought that if he would just make up his mind to stop, that he could stop. But he didn't want to, and he was just a bum. And that from that day on, I hated my father. I hated him good. And I used to say to my mother, I'd say, Mom, when I get big, I'll make I'll make a whole bunch of money. And I'll buy a little house in Jersey. And how about you and me, we go out there and live together? And she'd say, okay, Jack, we'll do that. And I'd say, we'll leave the old man home, huh? And she'd say, yeah, we'll leave him home, just you and me. And I know now that my mother was just trying to pacify me, because they were always forever taking me to doctors, you know. I didn't sleep well at night, and I didn't eat well, and I lost weight instead of gaining it, and I was a very nervous kid. I sleepwalk all the time. They had to tie me in a bed. I was upset tremendously with my father's drinking. So for me to stand here and tell you that my name is Jack Brennan, I'm an alcoholic, that's ridiculous. It's absolutely asinine, because I hated alcohol. I hated booze. I didn't want no part of the damn stuff. And when my cousins would come from overseas and they would bring a bottle, I used to curse them. And I'd say, you know, they'll leave here and everything will be fine for them, but my father will be drunk and it's going to be hell to pay and my mother's going to get hurt again. And I said, why do they bring it? And I couldn't understand it. I knew that alcohol and my father troubled. And I hated alcohol and I hated my father and I hated anything to do with it. Then why do I stand here? Why do I stand here and tell you that I'm an alcoholic? Because the Lord upstairs, the higher power, saw fit to make me an alcoholic. That's what it is. I had no choice in the matter whatsoever, and nor does any alcoholic. Because the good doctor tells us in that paper that the heavy drinker can stop drinking any time that he wants. But not so the alcoholic, different chemical body. So therefore, I stand here and tell you that my name is Jack Brennan, I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't like it and I didn't want it. But isn't that proof enough for anyone that I do suffer from a genuine bona fide disease, very similar to diabetes? Very similar in the results of diabetes. Because diabetes is a chemical disease just the same as alcoholism. Chemical imbalance in the system. And if there is a history of diabetes in a family, then it's 4 times to 1 greater chance that one of the children will be an alcoholic too, although the disease is not inherited. The same statistics hold true for the disease of alcoholism. So my father was an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic, and I have a son who is 30 years old, and he is an alcoholic. Nothing so strange when you know the reason. You see, it's not just a question that I shouldn't drink. It's just simply a question with the chemical body that I got, I just damn well can't drink, period. Because the disease of alcoholism, alcohol in the body of an alcoholic, affects the alcoholic in 3 ways. It affects him mentally, physically, and spiritually. It affects him mentally in that he doesn't know what he's doing and is capable of doing things that normally he would not want to do or do. Mental manifestation of a chemical disease that I suffer from. And then we have the physical manifestation of the same disease. Physical manifestation. When an alcoholic is coming off a drunk and you put a plate of bacon and eggs in front of him, he will throw up in the plate. Physical manifestation of the disease of alcoholism. And if he's waving to somebody on the other side of the street and there is nobody on the other side of the street, physical disease, a physical manifestation of the disease of alcoholism. And he walks down the street and talks to himself. And he looks like he's taking Mercurochrome for eye drops. You don't have to look very hard to find the physical manifestations of the disease of alcoholism. And then we come to the big one, the spiritual manifestations of the disease. What is spirituality? They tell us here in AA that there is no religion, and I believe that with all my heart. There is no religion in AA, but there is a spiritual the part of our program. Well, I had to find out what the word spirituality meant. A spiritual person is simply an individual who is wanted and needed and loved by his actions. Well, you can damn well sure see very quickly that the alcoholic is a very unspiritual person. Who the hell needs them? Who the hell wants them? And what idiot could love them? That's the way that it works. But here we have the one physical disease affecting us in three areas of our lives. Mentally, physically, and spiritually. It did me. I can only speak for me. I can only speak for me and with many, many years of experience. Watching all types of alcoholics live and die. I look at my own son, 30 years old. 16 years fighting the battle. In and out of AA like a yo-yo. In prisons, in hospitals, on skid rows. Stealing, lying, and cheating. Hurting little people, his little children, and there is nothing in this world that I could do about it. Nothing. But I tell you how that AA works. My being here tonight and helping one individual. Perhaps back in New York, there is somebody tonight that is helping my son. I don't know. I hope so. I pray so. Because I have done everything that I can for him. There is nothing more in this world that I could possibly do for him. So I must turn him over with love to the higher power. And I will say this to you, that any time that he wants AA, it is here for him. Thank God. Any time that he wants to throw in the sponge and accept defeat and thereby win, AA will be here for him. And I say the same to you. There is nothing that I can do for you. I can simply tell you about me and let you make your own decision. I pray that you make the right decision. Because the life that I live today is not to be compared in any which way, shape, or form the way that I used to live. You see, I picked up my first drink at age 12. A kid's trick. That's all that it was. A kid's trick. My brother and I were in a bedroom because it was Saturday and it was raining. And the old man was just starting on another drunk. My mother told me, Jack, get in the bedroom, take Joe with you and be quiet. And maybe it won't be too bad this time. And all I knew, I had that big knot of fear again in my belly. And I said, he's at it again. And it's going to be another long weekend. You know how that you have to walk on your tippy toes around him. Maybe he's sleeping. Maybe he's awake. Maybe he's out. Maybe he's in. Oh, I know what Al-Anon goes through. I know well. I lived it. I lived it. And I cursed my father and I prayed for him at the same time. And I never ever knew anything about the disease of alcoholism until I came to AA. Well, my father died without ever coming into AA. In fact, AA was quite young when he died. But here I was in his bedroom on a Saturday morning looking at four walls with a stupid brother who was 10 years old and a real dope. And he come up from under the bed with a bottle of wine and he said, Jack, look what I found. And I said, oh, shut up. Because I considered him to be a nitwit. Sometimes I still do, but he said, Jack, let's try some of it. I said, no, I don't want none of that stuff. I said, you try it. So he put it up to his mouth. It was a gallon jug, and he took a drink out of it. He said, oh, boy, it's good. It's sweet. And I looked at him. You know, I said, is it really? He said, yeah. So I watched him for a couple of 3 minutes, and he didn't fall down or anything, you know. And there was nothing else to do. I said, give me that stupid thing. Let me see what that is. So I took my first drink. It wasn't sweet. I don't know what the hell it was. Sweet, sour, but I know one thing. It was magic. Pure magic. Because that went in my mouth, and it hit my stomach, and all the fears that I had in my belly were gone just like that, in seconds. And I said, man, alive, no wonder the old man is sipping on this stuff. Yeah. And I said to my brother, Joe, go have another one, Joe. Hurry up. And he said, okay. And he had another one. He said, oh, boy, it's sweet. I said, man, I know you're stupid. Because, you see, he was not getting what I was getting. He didn't need the chemical alcohol. He was not an alcoholic. So he took alcohol as it was intended to be drunk. He took it and said it was sweet, and he enjoyed it. Me, I took my second drink, and I was wondering then, a quiet little kid that I was, you know, up until that time. I wondered out loud. I said, I wonder how hard I would have to hit the old man behind the ear with a milk bottle to kill him. See? Complete change instantly. Mental manifestation of the disease that I suffer from. I used to go to church and pray for my father. Now here I was wondering how I could kill him. I said to Joe, hey, have another one. He said, no, if you drink any more of that, you're going to get sick. And I said, you're stupid. If the Lord made anything better than this, he'd keep it up there for himself. And I believed it with all my heart. So I said, okay, you don't want any more? I'll have one. And I had the third one. And you know something? That's over 40 years ago. And my brother Joe, if you meet him in Lynbrook, Long Island, don't drink with him. Because he'll do the same thing to you. See, he took two drinks and then he quit. He left me standing there with egg on my face. And if you go to his home, he'll give you one drink. And then after a small space of time, he'll give you a second drink. And then a cork goes back in the bottle and the bottle goes back in the closet. And you just lit the fire and he's all through. And he's been doing that for 40 years. And that's what he did to me 40 years ago. And the next thing that I remember, it was Sunday morning. And my mother's bending over me and she's crying very bitter tears. And she woke me up and I came to like a scared deer. And I said, Mom, what happened? And it was just that horrible feeling that is so peculiar to alcoholics, remorse in the belly. You don't know what you did, but you did something. And I looked at her and I said, please stop crying. Please stop. Tell me what happened. And she said, Jack, please. One in this family is enough. I couldn't take two. And I said, what do you talk about? And she said, Jack, you drink almost 3/4 of a gallon of wine yesterday. And then you passed out unconscious. And your father and your brother put you in bed and you slept all night. And now it's Sunday morning. She said, Jack, what are you doing to me? And I looked at her in bewilderment. And I said, Mom, I didn't intend to do that. I said it was a mistake. And I said, please stop crying. It won't happen no more. No more will I ever do that. I said, please stop crying. Because for me to hurt this woman, it was just like to cut a baby's throat. I couldn't do it, you see. But even while she was talking to me, and I was assuring her that there was going to be no more, I was scheming. Because, you see, I'm an alcoholic. And I loved that relief that came with that little wine that I had the day before. I loved that feeling of security that it gave me. I loved the feeling of being at ease in a world that's all right. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want to be that round block in the square hole. I wanted to be like my brother. And if I had a little wine, I could be like my brother. In fact, if I had a little wine, I could go to school, and I used to tell a nun sister, you sit down in the seat, and I'll take over the class today. And I used to go to school with a little wine, too. Because, you see, there's no use to be an Irish Catholic if you don't use your head. And I was an Irish Catholic, and I was an altar boy. So I got the early mass. 6 o'clock. Nobody wanted the 6 o'clock mass. Only an alcoholic. And I used to get there and go into the sacristy, polish all the pieces up that I was supposed to, polish off a few drinks of wine. Man, I was in business. I want to tell you, they go first class in those sacristies, too. And then I used to meander over to the school, and I had it made. But you see, I used to run into alcoholic priests. And instead of, they used to get there 4:45, see, instead of 4:15. And that day, I didn't have no wine. And that day I was back in the corner, didn't eat a dunce, right? Couldn't speak, couldn't talk, couldn't do nothing. But what the whole point that I drive at is that I drank in order to live in this world. That's all I drank for. I don't know what it tasted like. I don't care what it tasted like. I drank in order to live. I drank in order to be like everybody else in this world. I drank in order to feel at ease. And they tell me that that's a sign of an alcoholic. If you need a drink in order to do anything, then you best look into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, 3,000 years ago, the Chinese, in the earliest recorded history, they had a perfect description of the disease of alcoholism. The Chinese 3,000 years ago wrote that the man takes a drink, and then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. And that's exactly what happened to me. You see, I had no shoes, and I never had a bike, and I had an alcoholic father, and I wanted nice things. And I went out and I got nice things. And I would stand here and tell you that what I tell you I'm not proud of. But I've hurt an awful lot of people in this world. I've hurt an awful lot of people, and I've stolen an awful lot of money. Because at the age of 16, I was a confirmed thief. I would do anything. And if you had money and I wanted it, I got it. And if I hurt you in the process, that was just too damn bad, wasn't it? And I'm going to tell you something. I ran with a mob up in New York, on the west side of New York, and I was a wheelman. And I've driven a car at tremendously high speeds when it was not stylish. Many years ago it was. And we used to use cars that were weighted down in the fenders, and I could take turns that police cars couldn't. And I've watched many a cop's car go over the drive and into the woods. And I used to laugh. And I've traded shots with police. And I've shot people. And I've been shot. And I've been stabbed. And all the while that I was doing all these desperate things, I was a 12-year-old scared kid. You see, I used to be a nasty individual when I drank. A tremendously nasty individual. And I was not quite satisfied with just picking up a joint and getting out. I invariably hit the guy that we stuck up over the bridge of the nose with a gun, and I can still see the results of it. I can see sometimes when I wake up and I have a nightmare, and I sit on the end of my bed and I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank God for the 12 steps that enable me to live with my garbage, because sometimes I see guys bleeding out of both corners of their eyes, and I can hear bones crunching in noses. And I could see the terror in people's eyes when I stuck a gun into their belly and laughed at them. Thank God for AA. You see, I was a nasty thief, and I cared not for anyone. There was no love anywhere in me. I hated each and every individual because I thought that life had dealt me a bad turn. My name was Crazy Jack the Umbriago. Umbriago means drunkard in Italian, and Crazy Jack was just about exactly what it means to you. Give Jack a drink, and he'll do anything. And people used to say, give him another drink, and let's see what he does next. But you see, people never saw me waking up in the morning. And I would wake up in some high-class hotel, or maybe a $75-a-day hideout, or some flea bag. And every time that I woke up, it was the same thing. 12 years old and scared. And I used to sit on the end of my bed and I would say, my God, what am I doing? And I would smell my gun and I would look for money in my pocket, and I generally had a whole pile of it. And then I would try to put the night before back together again. And I never could. And it was this way that I lost my first job on account of booze. Because how would you feel if you were a member of that mob and I was driving you at night and I got up the next morning and I started asking you, how did it go last night? And they used to get pretty shook up. And they would say to me, Jack, don't you know you drove the car? I said, yeah, but I was busy, you know. And one day they called me in. They said, hey, Jack, you know, you're a good wheel man. You're a lot of fun and you're nice people. We think you drink a little too much. And they asked me, what would happen, Jack, if one day, instead of taking us home, you took us to a police station? Well, I had to admit they had a point. So I lost my first job on account of booze. And I went out on my own. And I got in a lot of trouble. I stuck up banks that were closed for the evening. And I stuck up joints. The guy had just come back from the bank at the deposit and everything. And I stuck up payrolls on Friday, the afternoon payrolls. I got there on Thursday. I had one hell of a time because I didn't know too good what I was doing. And when I took a drink, anything went. And generally it was me. And people all along the line tried to help me, don't you know? There's social workers and psychiatrists and doctors and priests and ministers. And they would come in where I was locked up. I've been locked up and arrested over 225 times. Now, you could figure out exactly what for. Everything except murder. I have a police record that you wouldn't believe. And I would say that AA works. Because on the other hand, I'm an honorary policeman in 6 states at the AA. See? So you figure that one out. With my record, everything worked fine. Anyway, to get back to the beginning there, I was locked up and locked up and locked up, and people used to come in and say, Jack, we're going to help you. You're too nice a kid to be in here all the time. I said, I'm not having any trouble. And they would say, how come that you get locked up? I said, well, you win a few and you lose a few. And the guy used to say to me, well, don't you think you're losing pretty good? I said, yeah, but, you know, that's the breaks. And when I get out, it'll be different. Well, they all tried to help me by telling me that if I stopped drinking, they would do this and that for me. And I used to run them. I say, go away. Don't bother me. Go down there and help somebody else because all you're after is my booze. And I can't live without it. I need it. And when I get out of here, I'm going to get some booze and I'll be all right. In here, I'm nothing, but outside, I'm something. I couldn't see the handwriting on the wall. Well, I got down lower and lower, and along the way, I got married. My wife was a very innocent girl. She was a very naive, very simple girl. But not for long. Not married to me. Because I taught her all the nasty tricks that a person could. And I remember very clearly how it was in the beginning. She loved me very dearly, and I loved her as much as an alcoholic can love anybody. And I tell you something, that she did everything for me that a wife could do. And then she started asking me questions. Jack, when do you work? And that was a dirty name. I didn't, you know. And I would get her off that subject, and she would say, oh, when do you stop drinking? And I would get her off that subject, and she would start on something else. And one day she told me, she said, Jack, it's no good. You drink constantly, 24 hours a day. I never see you anymore. You're out more than you're in. And I was getting what is known as the treatment. And she said, I have to help you. Well, she didn't help me because I left home. I went away to sea when it was not a good time to go, but I went. I went in order to get away from prying questions. I knew that there was something wrong with my drinking. My brother had once told me, Jack, you're more like your father every day. He lost 2 teeth when he said it because I bashed him. And I said, don't ever, ever again tell me I'm like my father. He's a bum, and I'm not. He is nothing, and I'm something. And he said to me, Jack, he said, why don't you be more like me? Take 2 drinks and go home. And that's what I was trying to do. Be like my brother. Take 2 drinks and go home. Meanwhile, I left home. I went to sea, and I had a lot of trouble. See, trouble follows me somehow. I used to think that I was just... It was just awful. Everything would be fine all of a sudden, the out of blue. For instance, tonight, I stayed here in this place, or what is it, hotel or whatever that it is, a simple thing like a shower. I got all undressed, I got a bar of soap, and I jumped into the shower to take a shower before the meeting. No water. Yeah, you see? That used to be a regular occurrence with me. Tonight I was a little shook up. I stood there kind of stupid, you know. You turn on the boat faucet and nothing comes out. You say, what do I do now, you see? But they fixed it anyway, and we had a shower. But then it was a problem with me because I was always wrong again, and I tried so hard to be right. I tried so hard. I figured things out so good, and then bing. And I figured I'd go away to sea, and I'd get away from my wife, and I could send her money from here and there, and I went all over the world, and I had a ball. But one time I was standing on the dock of a ship, the deck and the rear deck, drinking a cup of coffee, half booze. I was happy. I was really happy. Had my booze, nobody questioned me, and all of a sudden I was in the water. And I couldn't understand it. And I asked the guy next to me, what the hell happened? And he said, you better hold on to this jacket. You don't look like you swim too good. I don't swim to this minute. But there I was in the middle of nowhere swimming. And he said, well, there's a war on. And I said, who's fighting? And he told me who was fighting. And I said, Jesus, I could get hurt over here, you know. And I asked him where the ship was. He said, straight down, 3 miles, you know. I got out of that, and they picked us up, and they took me into Cardiff in South Wales, and I stayed there for a couple of months drinking, and I had a ball. I had a wonderful... And one day they said to me, the ball game is over. Now, you either go home, or fly you home, or you take another ship. What do you want? And I thought about going home. I said, no, I don't want to go home. I don't want to go home. I didn't want to die either, but I sure didn't want to go home. And I figured if I went home, you know, here it was again. You're drinking too much. When do you sober up? When do you work? And I couldn't take it. So I said, oh, get me another ship and I'll take another ship. So I did. I got torpedoed twice more. And finally, I did get home. I got home from a hospital ship in the harbor of New York. And I had been in a coma for 16 days. I had a fractured skull, broken ribs, broken arm. I was busted up completely. Had been in a coma for 16 days, and when I came to, they told me, you're going home. And I said, no. And I don't want to go home. Well, they put me in a hospital, and they kept me in the hospital for 2 months. Then they sent me home. And I'll never forget the day. I walked into an apartment I had never been in. There was a kid in a chair, in a high chair, screaming bloody murder. And my wife was looking at me. She's so surprised to see me. And I said, hey, where's the booze? And I remember her face. And she said, Jack, I don't have any booze. I live here with the boy, our son. And she said, no booze. Aren't you glad to be home? I said, no. I said, run down and get a bottle of booze and hurry up. I need a drink. And she went down, and when she came back with the bottle, I said, now take that kid and go over to your mother's and stay over there till I call you. Noise. That's the boy that's the alcoholic today, you see. And I went into a bedroom in Brooklyn, and I looked out over Brooklyn. I fought the war 45,000 times. And I did everything I did. I just dreamed my dreams and couldn't work, couldn't do anything. Sit in a corner and drink. I was afraid to stop drinking. I was hearing little people talking at me, and it was a terrible way. And I had to have a bottle next to me and a bottle behind that all the time. I couldn't live without it. My wife came in one day and she said, Jack, you know, it's not right. You're killing yourself. And I need a husband, and my son there, our son there, needs a father. And she said, why don't you let me help you? And I said, get the hell away from me. You're just like everybody else. All you want to do is take away my bottle. And if you take away my bottle, I'll be dead, so leave me alone. Leave me alone and go away from me. Well, she was a good wife. And she said, I'm going to help you. And she went out and she got a big book of AA and brought it home and gave it to me. And I said, take it and you know what you can do with it. And I wouldn't read it. I wouldn't touch it. And I said, get off my case, leave me be, don't bother me. And I drank, around the clock, but she was a determined woman. And one day I came home at...
being out, you know. And I had been out for quite a few days. And she told me, she said, if you're not an alcoholic, then I want to tell you something. You better perform like a normal person. And the minute that you don't, there's going to be trouble. One day she shut me off in my bar. She wouldn't bring no more booze into the house for me. I had to go out. And I went out one day and I walked into a bar and the bartender almost died. He said, Jack, please get the hell out of here quick. And I said, what's wrong? He said, well, I'll tell you, your wife was here. And she said, if I even give you one drink today, she's going to burn my bar down tonight. And I said, she has lost her stupid mind. So I left there, went to Delicatessen, and he had the same treatment. I couldn't get a drink nowhere. And I went home, I was going to murder her. And she said to me, before you murder me, let me tell you something. I'll buy you a drink if you come with me. And I said, what do you want? And she said, just get on the subway, come to New York with me, and I'll buy you a drink. So I got on the subway with her for a drink. And when we got over to New York, I was shaking so bad, she bought me another drink. And then I said, now what? She said, we're going into this church over here. And I said, no, I don't want to go in there. She said, yeah, you promised. Now you've got to come. I said, what is it? She said, AA, and they're going to help you. And I said, yeah, they're going to help me just like everybody else helped me. I said, okay. I said, I'll go. So I went in, and I sat in the back of the room, and I said to the guy that was speaking from the back of the room, I said, all right, hurry up and help me. I got to get home. I didn't hear nothing that man said, nothing. All I heard was one thing, and that was the end of AA for me. I was sitting there shaking and shivering, waiting for another drink, and this guy is going on and on, and then he says, if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. I said, I'll kill you, you bastard. And I told my wife, I said, I knew that in Brooklyn. What the hell do I have to come here for? And I broke up that meeting. I got out just before the cops arrived. And I told her on the sidewalk, any time that you do that to me again, I'm going to bash you. I'm so hard. You'll never, ever straighten out of here. I'll kill you. I won't completely, but almost. And she said, you're hopeless. There's no more with you. You're hopeless. So I went my way, and she went hers. And I said, you go home. I'm going to stay here in New York for a while. I'll be home. I come home about a week later, and it was two cops in my apartment. And they were sitting there waiting for me to come. And I couldn't understand it. You know, I ran with the mafia, and you don't have to have cops in your home. If there's any here, by the way, tonight, peace. I don't want no trouble with you. But then with a different story, you don't have cops in your home. Nobody even talks to cops, you know. If you keep quiet, they'll go away eventually. But here they were in my house, and I asked them, well, what do you do here? And they said, we came here because your wife needs protection from you. And I laughed. I said, you're crazy. And she said, no, Jack, you were home last night too. Do you remember? I said, no. And she showed me her neck. And her neck was full of my marks. She said, you thought I was some German or Japanese or somebody who was killing me last night. She said, I'm going to take no more of it. That's it. You've had it. And I said, all right, we'll fight this out among ourselves. Get rid of these guys. And they wouldn't go. So I picked up and I threw the two cops out the door. And that was a big mistake. A big mistake. Because they went out and they got reinforcements and then they came back and then they threw me out. And for about the next 6 months, we were playing King of the Hill with my apartment, you see. And I would get out of there and I would walk the streets and I didn't know whether I was going or whether I was coming. And one day, I met a couple of them in the street. And I said a few things to them and they asked me, was I a tough guy? And I said, yeah, I was a real tough guy. And the next thing you know, there were six of them. And we were in the back of a building. And I'll never forget it. I had asked to go into the back of the building. I was a real hard guy. And I bounced a few of them. And then they come at me with sticks. And I remember laying on the floor and one cop with his knee in my throat begging me not to get up no more. He said, "Please, kid, don't get up no more because we're going to have to kill you." And I said, "That's about right. Yeah. Take your knee out of my throat and let me up." Well, to make a long story short, I wound up in Kings County Hospital in a straitjacket strapped to a bed. My both jaws were wired together. My eyes were shut. My head was a mass of stitches. 5 fingers broken on my right hand. My chest was caved in. And the horror of the whole thing was a big lump of blood that I had at the back of my throat and I couldn't spit it out. And every time I made a noise, some nurse came by and said, "Shut up or we'll put you in a violent ward." I lay there and I cried. I cried bitter tears. I cried maybe not outside so much, but I cried inside. And I thought about my mother and what she had tried to do for me and people I had hurt and my wife, as stupid that she was, but how nice that she was, you know, and my kids. I wasn't going to drink no more. I said, "I'm going to drink no more. That's it. I don't care. It's gone too far now, you see." 20 days later, they turned me loose out of that place. They told me, "Go away and don't come back because this hospital is for sick people. And you're not sick. You're alcoholic." So I went home. And I went home at night because I was so ashamed I wouldn't walk in the street, you know. And I went home when it was nice and quiet, and I thought maybe everybody would be in bed, but no, my wife was waiting on me. And she said, "Well, Jack, what are you going to do now?" And I said, "I don't know, but I ain't going to drink no more. That's it, I ain't going to drink no more." "Well, how does an alcoholic not drink no more? How do you do that?" "It's impossible. If you're an alcoholic, you drink. You have to drink. You have to drink in order to live. Unless that you come to AA and the people in AA teach you how to live without drinking. That's the only answer. The only answer." Now I sat in the corner and I was a 12-year-old kid and I was scared again. And everybody came to see the monkey in the zoo, you know. My brother came and he said, "What's the matter, kid? You having trouble?" And I said, "Please go away and leave me alone." And he said, "Come on, I'll get you a job. You want a job?" He didn't understand I couldn't walk in the street. I couldn't go and fill out no forms. I'm an alcoholic. I'm full of fear. I thought that every moment was going to be my last one. My heart used to pound like this in my chest. And I put my head down on the pillow at night to sleep. I could hear boom, 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 boom. Who understands that? Who? Only another alcoholic. And when the telephone rings and you fly into the bedroom because you know it's somebody for you. And if the kid drops a toy, you scream. You could kill him. Yeah, I know. And I sat in a corner and I sat in a corner because I needed a drink with all my body. I needed a drink. And I was afraid to take it. But the fear is overcome. That don't take long. And the past becomes the past very rapidly. And well, maybe it wasn't that bad. I'll try again, and I'll do it a little differently, and everything will be all right. And we con ourselves into believing this. And I told my wife one day, I said, "I can't sit in the corner no more. 6 days, I'm going crazy." And she said, "All right, what do you want to do?" I said, "Give me a dollar. I'll go down the corner, and I'll get one drink, and that's all. And then I could get on the subway, and I'll go to New York and get a job." She said, "Jack, I'm afraid." I said, "Don't be afraid. I know what I'm doing. I've been sober now for 6 days. I know exactly what I'm doing. I don't want to drink no more. You think I want to wind up in that dump again, strapped to a bed?" She gave me the dollar. And I went down to the corner. And I had one drink. And if God is above me, that's all that I wanted. One drink. And it was like somebody turned a key in my head. Mental manifestation of the disease of alcoholism. One drink is too many and 500 is not enough. So I had my second drink and now my mind is gone completely and I'm back to being insane as it tells us in the second step.
And I started thinking about the cops that beat on me. And I said, I'll find them. And I found them. And would you believe I found them 12 times. 12 times. Beat half to death, wrapped into a straitjacket, and stuck into a hospital, and tied to a bed, and left. I don't talk too good, because my jaws have been broken so often. And I don't see a blessed thing out of my left eye, because I've been blinded with police clubs. And I don't hear a sound on this side of my head. And if I turn my radio up real loud, I can hear pretty good on this side. And my equilibrium is pretty bad. And I walk sometimes like I'm half loaded. But I want to tell you something. I swore before God and everybody in this world that I was having no trouble with alcohol. Alcohol was my friend. It was the only friend that I had. I couldn't do anything except drink. It kept me alive. And my wife, the 12th time that I came out of the hospital, it was a little bit different. Just a little bit. They didn't let me go home. Two detectives grabbed me and they carried me to a police station or courthouse. And my wife was there and with my two kids, and one was an infant in arms, and that boy that's out there going berserk with himself tonight. And I said to her, what are you doing to me? And she said, I'm not doing anything to you. You did it yourself. And she said, the judge will tell you all about it, smart guy. And the judge got to me, he said, Jack, how do you feel? I said, I feel fine. How do you feel? See, inside I had milk in my stomach, ice water. I was scared, but I couldn't tell nobody. So when the judge talked to me, I had to be flipping smart. Real smart guy, me. I feel fine. How do you feel? I wanted to beg him, please let me out of here. I feel like a butterfly on the end of a pin. I didn't know what was coming next. And he read me a piece of paper. He said, the law makes me read you this piece of paper. He said, Jack, please try and understand. And I listened. I said, I'll understand. He said, I don't think you will. He said, because you know you're sick. You're more sick than you know. And he said, it's unfortunate, but you don't want any help. So he said, listen. And he read me a piece of paper. I thought he was talking about five other guys. Because it said that I was a homicidal maniac and that I might wipe my family out overnight and not even know that I did it. And it said this man will not live for the next 5 years. And if he does live 5 years, it will be in a mental institution suffering from wet brain. It said he is incapable of knowing the difference between right and wrong. He just doesn't understand anymore. And it also said that I would never work another day in my life. And it was also said that it was highly recommended by the three doctors that signed it that I be removed from my home for the protection of my family. And I said, that's not me. He said, yeah, that's you. When you drink, that's you. And he said, Jack, we can't tolerate you no more. Your wife is going to be dead, and we just can't have it, so we will have to take you from your home. And that was the day that I turned to my wife and I said, that's the way you want it. That's the way you got it. And I said, remember one thing, woman. You're going to need me before I need you. You think more of them two damn kids than you think of me. And she said, you bet your life I do. And she said, I want to tell you something. If you come back and annoy me once more, she said, I'm going to kill you. Because my children are going to have a chance to live. And they can't live with you. You are a maniac. And she said, Jack, I warn you. I'll tell you right in front of the judge. I'll stick a knife in your belly when you're sleeping, but if I catch you near my home again, you're dead. She said, now get out of my life and leave me alone. I went, and I was full of big ideas. You know, I told the cop, oh, you shut up, I'll be back. And they said, no, don't step foot in Brooklyn no more. Did you ever hear of anybody getting thrown out of Brooklyn? Unbelievable. Well, I got thrown out of Brooklyn. And I swore vengeance, I'll be back. Little did I know, as little does alcoholic know, that we are always going down, you see, down. The greatest gift that God could give me
and that I see myself as others see me. The alcoholic can't see himself as others see him. Because when he's on this level, he associates himself, I am not as bad as that guy. And tomorrow he's as bad as that guy, and he will find somebody else just a little bit worse to be not as bad as. Now I was at the end of the line. I went to New York and I told my wife, I'm going to get a gun and I'll make a few fast scores. I'll be back with a bunch of money and everything will be all right. She laughed. And well, she should have. I couldn't get a gun. I couldn't see me. I disintegrated into nothing. I went to the Barry. I went up Mulberry Street. They wouldn't even let me on Mulberry Street. Mulberry Street is the home of the mafia where I used to operate. I didn't know nobody up there. They didn't know me. I was a bum. So I wound up where all bums live, on the Bowery in New York. And I lived there for 2.5 years. And I lived in the summer and in the winter and in the snow and in the ice. And I was full of body lice. And I was full of blood, my own puke and my own filth. And I never took a bath and I never eat and I drank. And I drank just little bits of anything that came. I drank painted alcohol. I drank rubby dub, shaving lotion, anything that had alcohol in it. And I couldn't stand the stink of me. And I blamed my friend upstairs. And I blamed my mother. And I blamed my father. And I blamed my wife. And I blamed my children. And I blamed everything. And alcohol was still my friend. How sick can you get from a simple disease? How sick? I'll tell you how sick you could get. I crave God every time that I open my eyes, laying on the sidewalk in my own filth in New York's Bowery. I cursed anyone that came near me that had a pair of shoes on their feet. I cursed my mother for bearing me. And then I went out and found myself a drink of something to put me in Never Never Land again. And I used to wake up with big gashes in my head where I get hit with trucks or taxi cabs or fall down cellar stairs or subway stairs. And I never felt any pain. And I never felt the heat. And I never felt the cold. The only thing that I felt was the hate in my belly. I hated everything. Man upstairs 40 years ago told Bill Wilson, you stay here and watch this guy when he wakes up and don't leave today. And when he wakes up, you watch him because now, from what I tell you in this room, you understand him. Don't go, stay. Help him when he comes to. It was Bill Wilson leaving a hospital for the 57th time. Charity wards of hospitals. Not a big stockbroker, a helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic. Bill Wilson. Unemployable. And it was he that received the gift of AA from the man upstairs 40 years ago in a charity ward of a hospital in Akron. I understand completely. In my mind, the man upstairs did not want alcoholics fighting little people, little children, did not want wives crying in their aprons, did not want these people who were insane with alcohol. You're only 5% of the world, but hurting millions. He finally gave us a way, gave us a complete, gentle, easy way for the alcoholic to change his whole life and take care of his disease, the length to live with it. The doctor told Bill that day, Bill, it's a shame I got to turn you loose, but the law says I do. And he said, next week you'll be back here again 58 times. And one of these times, we're not going to bring you back. We're going to have to leave you dead because you're going to die or you're going to go insane. He said, Bill, before you leave, go look at that guy down there. We brought him in last night. Go look at you a week from today. The Bill went down in that room and he looked and he understood. He knew exactly how that man was going to feel. And he tells us in his own words that the whole room was filled with a great white light. And suddenly he knew that he didn't have to drink no more. And he didn't.
That was the miracle of AA. 40 years ago, and that's why we're all here tonight. The God-given, God-inspired program. You don't like the word God? Try higher power. A power greater than yourself. Anything that you choose to call it. But you'll one day come to believe, as I did, and as Bill Wilson did, that the guy upstairs loves us all very well. And he doesn't love me any better than he loves you. None of you. We are all equal in that respect. Bill came out of that hospital, and that was the beginning of AA, and some years later, my time came. Every alcoholic is watched by the higher power. Every alcoholic has his moment. And I say that the moment that you are brought here to AA by your sponsor, the man upstairs has a job for you to do. Don't go away. Stay and do the job. Learn and stay. You see, I was in a Bowery, in a dirty, filthy bathroom in the back of a dirty, filthy bar. And I was trying desperately to get down a morning drink so I wouldn't die. And I remember falling about in that filthy place. And I remember the first drink coming back. And I knew it was going to be a tough day. And that particular day was the toughest day of my life, and yet it was the best. Because after the fourth or fifth try at getting one down, hemorrhages of the stomach. And I fell down on the filthy floor because I was so weak. And I hooked my chin on the bowl, and I literally watched myself running down a toilet bowl. And every time I retched, more blood. And finally, I looked at the bottle that I was holding in my hand, and I said, that's my trouble. Alcohol. Can't be anything else. There is nothing else. Nobody's bothering me. I got it, now I can't drink it. And I took the bottle and I threw it over my shoulder, and I said, I ain't going to drink no more. I'm going to die. And I lay there waiting to die. And I didn't die. Because the man upstairs watches every alcoholic. And pretty soon things started to happen. I kept trying to stop from bleeding. And I tried to hold my breath a little longer at a time. And finally, I did pretty good, and now I couldn't move. I was so weak. And I want to tell you, I started to see pictures in my head. And my head was not too good, but I started to see a lot of pictures, color pictures, and beautiful and clear. My wife, places I had been, good times, bad times, mostly good times. And I was kind of starting to enjoy it, you know. It was like a coma. And then came one picture where I was up in the light looking down at everybody in a big room all milling about, all drinking coffee. And I couldn't figure it out what the hell it is. And then suddenly, like a bolt out of the blue, I knew. It was that AA meeting I had been at years before where the guy said, don't take the first drink and you won't get drunk. And I let out a scream and I said, you damn fool. You had it in the palm of your hand. You had the answer and you threw it away. And I said, you're a stupid idiot. And I cursed myself good. And from somewhere, I don't know where, I can only attribute it to my friend upstairs, came one thought. Maybe it's not too late. Maybe. And I crawled out of there on my hands and knees onto the sidewalk. And I begged anybody that came by, please call AA for me. And people were afraid to get near me because I stink so bad. And I remember trying desperately. My mouth was all busted up and my throat was all infected. Nobody could understand me. And I remember people running away from me, and I remember people pushing at me. Finally, somebody said, okay, I'll call them for you. And they called AA for me. And I sat down and I waited. And I trembled and I shook. And I wondered whether I was dreaming things again. I said, maybe it's a dream. Because the doctors were right, you know. My mind was badly damaged by booze.
and I didn't know what was reality and what was unreal. But I sat there, and I just sat, and I held on, and AA came. AA came. A little guy stood in front of me, and he had his wife with him, and she was littler than he was. And she said, "Oh, my God, look at him." And I remember he said, "Gene, it's all right. Don't worry about it. He won't hurt you." And then he come to me, and he said, "My name is Sam Cohen, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm here to help you." And I'll never, ever forget if I live to be 2,000 years old. I can never forget the look in that man's eyes. I can never, ever forget the understanding that he had in him. I knew then what the gift was that Bill Wilson was given 40 years ago. The gift of understanding one alcoholic for the other. You don't have to talk. You don't have nothing. You can see him and feel him across the room. And this is the empathy that the alcoholic has one for the other that they can't put in bottles. And they can't put it in pill form. And no doctor can learn it. And no priest or minister can absorb it. Not fully. It has to come from the heart, a gift from the higher power. One alcoholic understanding the other. He said to me, "Do you want to stop drinking?" I said, "Yeah." And he was a brave man. He got up close to me. And he said, "I tell you, if you want to stop drinking and you come with me and Gene, we'll carry you to AA and you don't have to drink no more and everything is going to be all right." This man had insurmountable faith. He flew right in the face of the doctors. Three of them said I was going to be dead in 5 years and I was pushing six. And I would never ever work again. I could never understand right and wrong. They gave me my ticket to death, and they were right. They were right, but they figured without the man upstairs, he has the last word. I came to AA, and Sam Cohn was right. He was my sponsor till he died 2 weeks before Bill Wilson did. And he taught me so much. He was a little Jewish fella, and his wife was a little Jewish woman, and the pair of them had enough love for everybody sitting in this room. How did I come to AA? I came to AA full of body life, one half of one sneaker on one foot, a dirty bottomless sock on the other, a filthy pair of pants full of blood and a shite. That's all I owned in this world. I was not allowed to step foot in Brooklyn, hadn't seen my wife or children for 2 years. No self-respecting cop would even club me. I was truly one of the least of anybody's brethren. If I can stay sober and I can learn how to live in AA, you can too. There is nothing that is impossible to a person who has faith. Faith will move mountains. You can move a mountain with a spoon if you got enough guts. And there is nothing that you can do in this AA program, because when the third step comes around and you turn your life and will over to the care of God, if you understand them, impossible things happen. Impossible. Well, I came to AA and I was just happy to be where they didn't throw me out. And I often wondered, I said, when they gonna find out what a bum I was and dump me. Never happened. People used to say to me, "Jack, keep coming back. We need you." You see, my definition of spirituality, to be wanted and needed and loved, is to be spiritual. I asked Sam Cohn one day, I said, "Sam, why do you say you need me?" And he said, "Well, we haven't got a dishwasher for a long time. Well, we need a dishwasher." They had lovely cups for 3 weeks. I broke every one of them, and nobody ever fired me. Nobody ever said a word. They bought paper cups and on. They said, "Jack, keep coming back. You're doing fine." And then one day, things started to get better. I got a job as a dishwasher. Didn't keep it long because they broke too many dishes. Then I got a little room, and I had to step outside the door to change my mind, but it was mine. It was my room, and I paid for it. And things started to get so better.
One day a guy called me up from Kings County Hospital and said, "Jack, I'm the morgue attendant over here." He said, "We got a guy in today just your size, got hit with a car. Come on over and get his suit." And I got my first suit from the morgue in Kings County Hospital. And it was a nice suit, too. It wasn't badly damaged, although he was. And I asked Bill about it. I said, "Is it right?" He said, "I don't know if it's right or not, but he ain't going to use it no more." So I wound up with my first suit and a job, and I thought that the world was beautiful. And Sam Cohn one day said, "Jack, you're helping an awful lot of people." And I said, "How do you figure that?" "I can't even talk to them." He said, "You don't have to." He said, "When we get new people in, we sit them next to you. And we tell them to watch you. And if they keep drinking, they're going to get like you." And I was so happy, you know. Oh, I thought that was great. And then one day he said to me, "Jack, you know, we all love you." And I said, "Sam, you know where I come from. Men don't love men." And I said, "You're not one of them funny kind of people, are you?" And he said, "No, no." He said, "We love you because you're an alcoholic. Now I want you to chew that one over for a little bit. Does your wife love you because you're an alcoholic? Or does she love you in spite of you being one? Which?" I know many people tolerated me in spite of my being an alcoholic. But now here, for the first time in my whole life, people loved me because I was an alcoholic and how good that it was. I went on and on, and days I grew. I started to remember a few names. I thought that the man upstairs had done me so very well. Oh, I was so filled with gratitude. And one day I said to Sam, I said, "Sam, you know, I owe you my life." And he said, "You're an ungrateful Irish bum." And I thought he was kidding. And I asked him, "Why do you say that to me, you know?" He said, "Because you are." He said, "Jack, what I did for you was done for me. And the guy that did it for me had it done for him. And if you carry it all the way back to the first one, the guy upstairs did it for Bill Wilson, so we all owed higher power." And I had to chew that one over. I said, "What are you telling me?" He said, "You're ungrateful because you never said thank you to the higher power." And I said, "Well, you know, I hate a lot of people." He said, "That don't matter. He sent me out to get you, so he loves you. You're here and you're growing in AA and you got shoes and you got a room. And he said, you don't still speak to the higher power. Shame on you." I said, "You're right." So I went out that night, and I didn't take the bus home. I walked. And I told my friend upstairs, I said, "You know, hey, friend, that lonely stupid over here is wrong." So anyway, thank God I do go along day by day for 28 years. My wife came back, and she came to meeting one day. I thought she was going to have me arrested. I ran in the kitchen. Sam Cohn spoke to her, and he came in. He said, "She wants to talk to you." I said, "I don't want to talk to her. She's going to hate me again." And he said, "No, you're wrong. You're in AA now. The guy upstairs is working for you. Things are going to get better. Go out and talk to her." Well, I said, "Oh, boy, you something, you." So I said, "Watch her hit me with a warrant or something." So I went out, and you know, she didn't want nothing from me. She wanted me. And I was so amazed. And I said, "Well, what do you want with me?" She said, "Well, you have a room, and you pay for it, and I'm not doing too good on welfare with the kids. So you come home, sleep on a couch in the living room, and pay me what you pay for the room." Oh, I said, "That's great. Yeah, I'll do that." So I came home, and I was a boarder. And my kids went to school. I used to wink at them. I didn't say nothing to them. You know, I just looked at them. And I was so happy. And then one day she said to me, "Isn't that couch getting kind of hard?" And I said, no. Talk about the use and abuse of alcohol. Oh, boy. And then she started making improper advances to me. Yeah. So I went up to Graymoor. Graymoor is a monk's retreat, you know. And I went up there and I talked to a monk. And I said, hey, that woman is, you know, she's making noise like a wife again. He said, oh, that's good, go home. I said, how the hell do you know it's good? You're a monk. Yeah. So I went home. Hardest thing I ever did in my life. And everybody was so nice to me. I had 3 children. Now, I had 2 then. And you know, my daughter used to sit on a lap when I was eating. And she'd say, come on, Pop, you could do it. And she'd stuff a knife in my hand and make me squeeze it. And she would work it forth and back and cut the meat. Because I had 203 stitches in that part of my right hand. They told me I'd never use it again. My daughter said I could, and I did. And when the kid went to bed, you know, I used to go down the basement with my wife. We had a big mirror down there. And she used to sit me in front of the mirror, and she'd say, okay, now you say this word, and you say that word, and you say it until you stop spitting on the mirror. I had no ego. I didn't know nothing about these things. I didn't know that people could love you so much, you know. I didn't understand nothing about anything except hurting people and stealing and lying and scheming and conniving. And I learned from my children and from my wife what love was all about. And I put all the hate and misery out of my heart. I made my past the past. And I started to live a new way of life, taught to me by a little stupid Jew in New York and Brooklyn. And I don't know what that it is that's so important. The only thing that's important about me, I think, is that I have guts enough to stand up here and tell you how that it was. That's all. I work hard for a living. I work with my hands. I don't make a hell of a lot of money, but I get tired around 2:00 in the afternoon, and I go home and have a little nap and get at it again the next day. I'm 58 years old. I'm not a kid. What's important? The important thing is that I've been able to survive and reach out and help other people to survive too, by telling them about my bad times and also my good times. See, I have enough faith for everybody sitting in this room. And you wouldn't know it when you see me on a plane with the White Knuckle Club, but I have faith. I have faith here in AA. I have faith for my son. One day, he will see the light. He will come too. 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I don't remember when, the doctors were right. I have a little trouble remembering dates. My wife died suddenly at 1:00 in the morning. Some kind of heart of trouble, never sick. And here was a woman that we were just now enjoying. My third son had come along and he was in college, and we would sit by the TV and we would laugh at stupid things, you know. We were really living. And then one day at 1:00 in the morning, the guy upstairs decided he needed her more than I did. And at 5:00 in the morning, she was dead. And it was a January, and it was bitter cold. It was almost zero weather. And I had gotten out in the car without a shirt and without shoes. And I remember leaving her in the hospital on a hospital bed, dead, and walking out into the cold and saying to my friend upstairs, what the hell are you doing to me now? And you know, he didn't do anything to me. The word came back to me real quick. Jack, I gave her back to you for 24 years.
You had your chance. You got another boy, and you put your life together. She died happy. What am I doing to you? I didn't do nothing to you. And he's right. So I was very lonesome for a little while, and then I went about my business, you know, in AA, and I got to Oklahoma, and I met another girl down here, no thoughts of being married or anything, another woman. And she had had a hard life, too, and she was in AA, and we got acquainted, and I met her here and there and the other place. And so now I'm married again, and I live in Kansas. And I still go out and speak at AA meetings. And I love AA so much. I love AA because it's just not a way to stay sober. It's a way to really live. And for the alcoholic, he goes like a meteor, head and shoulders above normal people, because he is specially blessed by the man upstairs. I believe that. And the Lord must love alcoholics pretty good to give us all this AA that we have. And if I lived to be 1,000, I would say to anyone coming in, put your heart into the program. Take the program into your heart. Take the steps and absorb them and study them and practice them. Because there are greater things at the end of the 12th step than you ever dream of having. I never knew that I would be a banquet speaker. It's a joke to me, really. People call me and ask me to come, and people tell me about my tapes, and I say, no, 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 not me. My friend upstairs. I simply open my mouth and out it comes. So if I've helped you here tonight somehow, I thank you for letting me. Because for me to carry around such a burden of gratitude that's in me, it would surely strangle me if people like you didn't allow me to come and get rid of it. So I woke up this morning and I said my little prayer as I do every day. It's called The Secret. If I meet my God in the morning when my day is at its best, and His presence comes like sunrise, like a glory in my breast. And all day long that presence lingers, and all day long He stays with me, and we sail in perfect calmness over every troubled sea. So I think I know the secret, learning from many a troubled way. You must seek Him in the morning if you want Him throughout the day. And when I have that prayer out in the morning and in my heart, then I have my coffee, my cigarettes, and that's a good day. Today is a good day. I have some copies of that prayer here. If you'd like to take it with you, please do. And I would like to thank the people that invited me here. And when I leave here in the morning to go to Indiana, I have very fond memories of the way that you've treated me here today, and I want to thank you for it. I'd like to leave you with a little blessing. May the roads rise with you. May the wind always be at your back. And may the sun gently warm your face and the rain softly fall on your fields. And until we meet again, may the good Lord hold us all in the hollow of His hand. Thank you, and God bless you.